Moncrief on News Talk.
The longest building in Ireland is in Cork, and it was once known as the Cork District Lunatic Asylum, a place that was once, as you can imagine, the location for countless harrowing stories. Now it's the setting for a new book called Said the Dead. The author is Dearan Ní Griffith. Dearan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sean.
Describe the book first, because it's not a novel. It's not quite metafiction, because there are real characters in it, or characters who did exist, kind of thing. So would it be fair to say the two main characters in it are Lucia Fitzgerald, the doctor, and kind of you?
Kind of.
Yeah.
I suppose the best way of describing it is that it's based on a very true story.
Yes.
So there's elements of real lives and real people there that are based on real research that I did and was kindly permitted to do in Cork City and County Archives, where I would arrive each day and open the case books from a very particular period in the history of this building, which was from the 1890s to the 1920s. And I would just spend hours and hours, hundreds of hours, to tell you the truth, reading these casebooks. And within each casebook were the real lives of real women who were arriving and being brought to this institution in mental distress, seeking help.
Mm-hmm. And why did you pick that particular period of history?
Well, I suppose in a way I was following a doctor. What became clear very quickly to me was that one of the doctors who was initialing the entries about the patients was a woman, a young woman from Waterford, who was at the time called Dr. Lucia Strangman. And I was fascinated by her and what would have brought a woman in 1896 to qualify as a doctor, to arrive at this vast institution, to move into it. I mean, she lived there in two little rooms. She married one of the other doctors there. She gave birth to her children there among her own patients.
Huh.
And so this life was fascinating. And the act of following her life was what drew me through those years. So I was kind of following her career there, I suppose. But also it's important to say that the archive, like a lot of archival institutions in Ireland, and like we're familiar with from the 1926 census, really respects the anonymity of more recent patients brought to the institution, because they implement a 100-year rule. So that was the point where the research ended.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was able to follow roughly the path of this doctor's career and all the women she met.
Mm. Now, were there men and women there? Presumably they were in different sections.
Yeah.
Big was it?
It was really, really vast. And I mean, the building still stands in Cork, so people will be familiar with it. But the institution was divided into halves. So the kind of western half was the women's wings. And then there was a central administrative building. And then the eastern half was for the men's rooms. And I suppose we never know what subjects we'll be drawn to as writers. And as I was beginning this research, I was really struck by the volume of records that were available within the archives. And maybe because I am a woman, I found myself particularly drawn to the women who had been there. And I visited the male casebooks a few times, and it might just have been the ones that I was opening, but there were a lot of descriptions of violence, sexual violence towards children, for example, that I suppose I knew I wasn't the writer who would be able to handle that kind of material. And so I tended to focus more on the women, on the women's side of things.
But also, I suppose, in that era, and into the 20th century as well, there were forms of so-called mental illness that seemed to be specific to women, kind of hysteria in the history. Were there many cases like that you came across?
I mean, there were. Yeah, there definitely were. And what you come up against is the understandings of people in mental distress, the labels applied, the kind of distillation of what might have been, in inverted commas, causing these issues in someone's life are sometimes very difficult to read, and the language sounds extremely harsh to our ears. You know, even like I could see you were struggling at the beginning there to say the word lunatic sounds so strange to us. And I think that that's a good thing, because hopefully it means that language is adapting in line with societal understandings that of mental distress, and that so many of us often go through episodes like that. But yeah, that language can be really difficult sometimes.
Were many of the people put in there by their families for possibly dubious reasons?
I mean, many of the people were definitely brought there by their families. And I expected, as I was embarking on the research for Set the Dead, that I would encounter, I think we have that presumption that a lot of people were brought there because their families wanted rid of them. And I felt I did encounter that in reading between the lines of the doctor's entry sometimes. But what I was very struck by was often when the doctors were documenting women arriving to this institution, they were saying her mother brought her in. And then sometimes someone would be so intensely drawn into themselves or so distressed that they wouldn't speak, and you would have a family member speaking for them. This is what happened. You know, she has a broken heart. And then you encounter someone's genuine upset at what is happening to them, filtered through someone else's words. And for me, I really felt for those family members often, you know, where they would, like there was one woman who brought in her sister, and the woman herself was working as a servant in a big house, and her sister arrived in great distress to the door saying she'd been seeing balls of flame passing before her eyes and she'd run away from her job and she just wanted to sleep in her sister's bed. And the sister in her work could only mind her for so long before this was her only option, was to bring her beloved sister to an institution like this, seeking help for her, wanting someone to mind her and help her. So I think part of the research really led me to realise that these kind of moments can be so hard for families and still are, and that these are issues that families still face. And what I was expecting in attempting this research surprised me, because I had certain preconceived notions and I was astonished by a lot of what I found there. I think that's the way, though, for everyone with research, and people researching their family history will have experience of that. You have an idea of what you're going to find, and then the closer you tiptoe towards the real documents and the real history and what remains of people's real lives, the more they surprise you, because you're looking at someone else's humanity. And with this institution, it has some real episodes of real, real darkness in its history, Sean. I can't underline that enough.
Yeah.
But there are also moments of humanity where people are trying to look after each other.
Yeah. Did the women get out? Were they helped?
I mean, this was one of my own embarrassing notions I had before I wrote Set the Dead, was that when I would look at that huge building in Cork, I would assume people who were brought to that institution were probably kept there till they died. And that is so sad. And I felt such compassion for them. And that did happen to an awful lot of people, which is such a tragedy and such a loss to Irish life. I think that so many people were locked in these institutions. But what surprised me as I was reading the case books were the sheer number of people who, in the doctor's language of the time, and the language is very much of its time, that they would write discharged, recovered, and would leave the institution, walk back down that hill into Cork City and return to their lives and never come back to that institution again. And what in writing this book, I had to teach myself how to do this kind of research. So because I'm such a nosy person, I would often try to follow those people. So a woman, for example, that would be walking away from that institution following treatment for severe, what we would call postnatal depression, returning to her family. And then you could trace her into other archives and see from births, deaths and marriages, say that then she had further children. And then you'd find her in the census. You'd be able to visit her home where she once lived. And you would like to think that these people had a kind of happy ending, and as much as any of us have a happy ending in our lives muddling through. But it was so moving to turn a page in the casebook and see the words discharge, recovered, and then follow someone and see them returning to their own lives.
What kind of treatments were there for them?
I mean, the ways in which a vast institution like that attempts to care for people, say in the 1890s, for example, or even into the 1900s, they will take you in and they will write in detail in the casebook about who you are and how you appear physically. And oftentimes those descriptions of the women entering the institution were so moving because words like emaciated were used, scarred by vermin bites. So you know that these people, we have a certain imagination of what the past might have been like in Ireland, but these were often women coming from circumstances of extreme poverty, which is even difficult to imagine, I think, for us, you know, but it was written in their bodies. They were so hungry. They oftentimes had had 9, 10 children and they were in their 30s. They're really, really struggling. And I mean, I've had 4 children. I know what that period is like after having a baby. I can't imagine doing that while having 9 other children to look after and not have a washing machine.
Yes, yes.
You know, we take so much for granted. And so if you were to approach that kind of institution in those circumstances, the vast institution would be seeking to care for you in ways like feeding you up. So the doctors would document like really hearty diet for particular people, right down to like, you know, regular beef tea and a glass of wine per day written as a prescription, you know, or like 3 pints of milk for this person. And so they would aim to do that. They would aim. Now, this isn't to say that they would succeed because things like overcrowding often thwarted these kind of efforts. But this is what was documented in the casebook. They would seek to make sure that you were as well rested as possible. Again, I don't know how that was achieved with so many people sharing a room, but and then they would have things in inverted commas like amusements, where there would often be live music in the ballroom. Dancing was encouraged. There would be games and like hikes and that kind of thing. So a lot of outside time and a lot of the doctors would often praise people who engaged in those kind of activities. But I had a lot of empathy for the women who were documented as like rolling their eyes and being like, I'm not doing this. Yes. There's no way I'm not doing this, you know. But so that was how they would attempt to look after people. And what you often find is that when women were given that kind of attention and looked after physically by the doctors, because a lot of them were dealing with birth injuries and things like that as well, then you would have them recover kind of slowly but surely. But then there are so many other very sad cases of people who just continued to struggle and really had genuine problems and really suffered in there, you know, and never got out.
Did Lucia work in that hospital for all her life or did she go someplace after?
She worked there for all her working life. But at one point, herself and her husband were given a house at the other end of the grounds of the hospital. And they decided to start this, what I think of as a really radical clinic from the front room of their home, which was focused on talk therapy. Like, can you imagine Ireland in the 1910s inviting someone? And their approach was, it just seems astonishing to me still. What they wanted to do was eradicate the need for anyone to have to go to the hospital down the hill. They wanted to, and they have wrote about this. That's how I know about it. And I was so delighted when I was doing the research for Said the Dead and found this article that described their methods in detail. So they would, it was really important to them that this clinic they were running would be free of charge and freely available to anyone who needed it, who was in the early stages of mental distress, so that families could bring people there where they were really worried about them. But they would come, what we would think of as like kind of like popping in, I suppose, and that there would be like an hour of treatment with the doctor, and that gradually, and the way they would treat them, they would bring them in, close the curtains, lie on the sofa, tell me what's wrong and I'm going to listen. And you just tell me everything that's on your mind. And sometimes they would do what they called mesmerism, which kind of like a light hypnosis. Yeah. And so you can imagine how taken aback I was to discover this and to imagine my way into that room, and where they really thought that they would be able to eradicate any sense of mental distress, as I say. They thought this was it.
That is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And how much foresight is in that? Because we could still do it with that now.
Absolutely.
If it was a place you could just walk into and say, this is what's on my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so moving to me to imagine that there were people like this who were opening their home to people and putting themselves entirely out there free of charge and inviting people to come to them to be helped, you know. So moving.
Yeah. Dearan, thank you so much for coming in to tell us about that. The name of the book is Said the Dead. Dearan Ní Griffith is the author. Dearan, thanks a million again.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.